Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I'm your host, Nick Schutt, here with my buddy Kamyar Mazerat. Kamyar, how are you, man?
Good, how are you?
Dude, it's another day in paradise. Thanks so much for asking. We had, I don't know if you were tracking the weather, but we're recording the week that we were supposed to get like 18 inches of snow that just got canceled. So I'm like both happy and sad about it. I'm not sure which one is gonna win out. But yeah, man, I appreciate you coming on and hopping on. I know how busy you are.
Of course, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Absolutely, man. So if you don't mind, Kamir, for everybody that doesn't have the fortune of knowing you yet, you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here, man.
Sure. Kamyar Mazerat, I'm a senior counsel at Foley and Lardner. That's an international law firm. But I'm here in the DC office, and I specialize in intellectual property law. But then even within that, I specialize in patent, and within that, I specialize in software-enabled innovations. So a little bit about my work history. I graduated from engineering school, and I practiced engineering for about 4 or 5 years before I decided I don't think I'm smart enough for this. I need to go to law school. So then I went to law school. I graduated in 2013-ish, and I got recruited to IBM. So I started doing my legal career at IBM, and just completely purely out of complete chance, I was shuffled into with some very smart people at the Watson AI program. Now, this is 2013, 2014, so it's really early. AI was not what it is today. And they actually gave me two options, my boss, that well, you can do chip design, do IP work and legal work for chip design, and you'll be closely working with that team, or there's a new team and they do AI. It's called Watson. And I'm like, I don't really know much. And they're like, we'll teach you. We have classes. We have this. And I figured it's probably a little bit easier. So I was there for a couple of years. I worked with some very smart people. We worked on some really cool technology, which now I look back, that was 12 years ago. I look back and some of the stuff was really groundbreaking at the time. It's funny. At the time, IBM would offer 15 free minutes of the Watson model to anybody. So you could sign up, give your email, and they would give you 15 for free minutes. And you could play around with the model, kind of like what ChatGPT does now. Of course, 12 years ago, 13 years ago, it was not as sophisticated. But I couldn't get a single friend of mine to join. I couldn't get anyone in my family to join. Everybody was like, ah, this thing is like a chatbot. I'm like, no, AI is real. I'm like, no, thank you. And now they're all about AI. So after IBM, I decided to join private practice, and because of my background, and because that time, 2016-ish, it coincided with a lot of bigger corporations understanding what AI was and how powerful it is and how they can harness it, I basically got a lot of AI projects, and it's never really stopped. So I am a patent attorney. I'm an IP attorney, but most of what I do is basically in two columns. About 90% of what I do is AI-enabled innovations or products and or fintech. So that's basically what I do. And for the past couple of years, I've been getting into some quantum computing because that's just something that I've always been interested in. So I went back and I took a few classes and I got a certificate in quantum computing. It reminds me a lot of what AI was back in 2013. And I think there's huge potentials, and we'll talk about it today and how powerful it is. But that's basically a brief description of what I do and how I'm involved in this crazy world.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate that, and I appreciate all the work you've done it to help advance the space over the years. I know, like I one of the things I always tell, because being an entrepreneur, I have people like talk to me about, oh, business this, business that. One of the things that I like people always underestimate is the number of ancillary skills that you need as a business owner, right? Whether like.
Right.
You have the most brilliant idea for the next AI model, right? Whatever. If you don't protect it properly, have the right relationships with folks like yourself to make sure that you're setting yourself up You're gonna lose the right to go out and make that, use that exclusively, right? Other folks can come in and take it over. And so
Oh,
yeah,
yeah.
it's a because it's I mean it's a dirty game on that side, right?
Right. You got to protect your competitive advantage. That's very important. That's what we provide for our clients.
Absolutely. And so what I mean, so for folks that don't know, I know we're talking about quantum today. What is quantum computing? What does it mean, and how does it differentiate from classical computing,
Sure.
what we've all known and have been using for, 50, 60 years?
Sure. So let me give you a brief description and then we'll delve into it. It's really a hard question to answer. So quantum computing is basically a new paradigm of computing that leverages principles of quantum mechanics to process information, process and analyze information in a new slash fundamentally different way than classical computers, which use deterministic principles. Now that definition is so clean cut and it's fantastic. The problem is when I tell that to people, no one really knows what that actually means. So let's delve into a little bit about what happens there. And I'm not a physicist, so bear with me. I've taken classes, but quantum mechanics is just one of the most complicated things that I've ever studied. So the word quantum was first coined in 1900 when the scientists were trying to explain certain experimental results that didn't really fit within the classical paradigm of physics. So classical physics it treats everything in a deterministic way. Let's say you have a pool table and these two balls hit each other and then they bounce off each other. So you can actually calculate, okay, let's look at the velocity, angles, the weight of the ball, the material of the pool table to figure out the coefficient of friction coefficients. And we can actually calculate how they bounce, where they go, the velocity. In the quantum world, interactions are not the same. When two molecules meet or interact, they don't really bounce off each other the way two, let's say, pool cubes would bounce off each other. Their interactions are not cannot be ident or calculated in a deterministic way. It's more of a probabilistic way. So their interaction exists in a realm where multiple outcomes are possible at the same time, and one actually manifests when it's observed. So quantum mechanics is a fundamental shift in our understanding. Quantum mechanics really explains the fundamental nature of our universe at a atomic and subatomic level. And it basically says we don't have a fixed sense of what's going on. It's not deterministic, it's probabilistic. Now, why is it that we're talking about quantum mechanics and how what does that have to do with computers? Well, quantum computing uses the principles of quantum mechanics to analyze data. And this kind of sort of happens a lot in some scientific areas and scientific fields. Sometimes scientific discoveries are applied to different areas, and the result is actually fantastic. I give you one example, and this might deviate a little bit about quantum
Please.
computing. But so many years ago, these astronomers they believed that there are gases in the universe, and they wanted to study them. Of course, you can't just go up and grab a sample and come back to the Earth and study it. So these group of scientists, they said, well, different material based on the nucleus of different material, they resonate different when they're exposed to magnetic fields. Same magnetic field, different nucleus, they resonate differently. So what we can do is we can actually measure that, then figure out based on that resonance what gas it is that it is, in the universe. And that actually worked. And then many, many, many years later, someone said, well, if that's the case, then why can't we apply that to a human body? So then they created a tunnel, created a magnetic field, put a person in it, and they actually measured the resonance of different things. And that is actually an MRI machine. It's a magnetic resonance imaging. So something that belonged to astronomy was applied to the medical field. And we have the most potent imaging system right now that can actually show because the cancerous tumor in the lung resonates differently than the actual lung. So when you measure that stuff, you can actually figure out and say, oh, well, that thing does not look the same as everything around it. And then many years later, someone said, well, these are all data. Why don't we apply it to AI? So that's an example of three different scientific fields and areas that kind of come together to provide something that we all use. So to go back to quantum computing, quantum mechanics has existed. I'm not sure when, but some group of scientists in computing science, they said, why don't we apply that to computers? Why don't we use that to compute? So, how does quantum computer work and why is it different? So, most of us know what a bit is. Classical computers, they work with zeros and one, on off switch or thumbs up, thumbs down, and it's a binary classification of data. Well, quantum computers, they work based on this concept of qubits, quantum bits, and it includes zero, one, but it also includes what they call a superposition, which is zero and one. And that superposition can be both of the outcomes, kind of like in quantum mechanics. As I mentioned earlier, the result doesn't really manifest itself until it's observed. The same thing kind of applies here. So a good example, everyone talks about the Schrodinger's cat, that there's a box and the cat's dead or alive. I think a better example, or maybe a simpler example, I shouldn't say better example, is you have a coin and you flip it off and you see if it heads or tail. Well, you don't really know if it's heads or tail unless it lands. And if it's still spinning in the air, that's a superposition. So there's a 50% chance that it's going to be heads, 50% chance it's going to be heads, tails. Now, in the concept of, let's say, an electron spinning, if you say when the electron is at the very top, that's a one. When it's at the bottom, it's a zero, and everything else is going to be between. There's a 50% chance that electron is going to be up or down when you observe it. But that doesn't really stop there. It could be 80-20, it could be 60-40. So a good example of what superposition in a qubit work is, it actually comes from a very interesting book called Quantum Supremacy. I think I'm butchering his name, but I think it's Michio Kaku. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He mentioned something about thumbs up, thumbs down, and that's classical. But then for quantum, you have all the angles around it. That's why a quantum computer is so much more powerful than a regular computer, a classical computer, because it fundamentally looks at data and analyzing data in a different way. That's not the only reason. There are other things like entanglement, there's tunneling, there's all the other concepts that we don't need to get into. But at the very basic level, it's better than, or it's different than a classical computer, not because it's faster. That's a byproduct of the reason, of the byproduct of the fact that it's fundamentally different. It's faster for sure, but it's not just a faster computer. It's a different type of computer. The superposition can be entangled, or the qubit, sorry, can be entangled. Now, we don't really need to get into what entanglement is, because mainly not that many people understand why it happens. But theoretically, a qubit, let's say a spin of an electron in one qubit, can sync with another qubit. So those spins can sync and they will be the same spin. Now, theoretically, if you even take one qubit away to another country, thousands of miles away, that the fact that they sync and they spin together will not change. Now, that by itself helps parallel processing. And that's another reason why quantum computers are so much more powerful. Right now, quantum computers are in their infancy. But as we identify, when I say we, I mean the scientific community, they identify new modalities and more efficient ways, it's just going to get better and better and better. So I'll stop there if you have any questions regarding this.
Well, I mean, a lot. You did a really good job, explaining some of the basic principles of it, I think. And it sounds like really we're moving from like classical computing is just black and white, right? Like it's either yes or no, up or down, left or right, east or west, right? When in reality, there's a lot of gray in between that, which is really where
Exactly.
life happens. Like this is like one of my problems that I always had with school. In classes in general, is I felt that like, and like speaking of from a political science perspective, is they talk about things like capitalism, communism, socialism, fascism, as if they're all separate entities,
Right.
separate things, right?
Right.
But in reality, there is no pure implementation of anything anywhere because that's just not how the real world works, right? We don't have just a capitalist society, right? You can have a capitalist-based society with a lot of social programs involved. Like look at most of Europe, how they do things, right? Where it's, yeah, we're, capitalist in these ways, but we have these social programs to help folks, and and so the world operates in grays. So we're moving out of more, we're in the process of moving out of a black and white era into a gray era is what it sounds
Yeah,
like.
exactly.
And from a functional perspective, right? Like, 'cause that's great in theory. From a functional perspective, on a day-to-day basis, how would that change? Before we go there, what are the things that we need to do to, what are the major problems right now?
Oh, good
And
question. Yeah.
why aren't and what are the major challenges we need to overcome to really implement quantum? And start utilizing it more broadly.
That's a great question. Why don't we have it if it's this great, right? So what are the impediments? So in order to answer that question, let me tell you the modality that most people use now, and then that might shine some light on why it's so hard to get this going. So and I want to give you this caveat that the modality that we're using now, I think in 15, I don't know, 10 years, 5 years, some other year, someone's going to come up with a much better modality. And they're going to look back at us the way we look back at, those punch cards with computers, with the papers that went in. And we're like, wow, how silly were those people? And then
Right.
they're going to look back and then they say, wow, in 2025, those silly people were using ion trapping. So there are different modalities that people use. The principal one now, it's called ion trapping. So imagine you have an atom. You can take one electron out. Electron is negatively charged, right? So when you take one out, I show this as if it's like someone grabs it, but let's just go with that. You take one out and it becomes an ion. Ion is a positively charged material, right? So you keep that material, you keep the electrons in place using magnetic field, pulsating magnetic field. And using laser, you can manipulate that. And that will show quantum properties. And that's how you can actually figure out, hey, this is a zero, this is a one, this is a superposition. So the a qubit right now is that. Now, the problem with that is when you do that, that material becomes highly volatile and it wants to interact with everything and anything. It becomes very sensitive to vibration. So whatever your computer is, cannot move at all. And most importantly, it becomes very sensitive to temperature. So you need extremely cold, near zero. And by zero, I mean zero Kelvin,
Yeah,
negative
absolute zero.
200. Yeah.
Absolute zero, not like
Absolute
zero
zero. Yeah.
degrees, right? Where it's,
Not like outside right now. Yeah.
right,
No, you
yeah.
need real cold. Yeah. So that's obviously hard. If you actually, see one in person or, Google one, and watch the video, it's very, it's basically as big as a maybe a minivan. It's like an upside down cryogenic chamber or fridge. And for the magnetic pulses, you need these devices and they make loud noises. So it's an entire room, and it's dedicated to a chip that's this big. So that obviously creates some problems, right? And that's not even a perfect solution because the quantum properties dissipate after a while. So the coherence is a problem with that. So you need to make sure that errors are not, inevitably errors will be introduced after sometimes a short time, sometimes a longer time. So that is not the best process, but this is the best one that we have so far.
Yep.
Hopefully somebody will come up with a new way. I know that there's a lot of people who are working on some new modalities. But one of the biggest problems is that is hey, it's kind of hard to keep an ion trapped, as they say, for the long enough that you can do a meaningful computation. So
How
that's
long?
number one. Number two is, it's a newer technology, and we don't really, frankly, the workforce is not as sophisticated or as trained as classical computers, right? So that's always a problem. But I think number three is the most important problem, and it's a money issue. It's because it's new, because a lot of people don't really know about it. Money has not flown, and even though, and we'll talk about recent activities by U.S. and China and how it has increased recently. Overall, we need a lot more money, and the money will go to these researchers and universities. It will go to private sector, and then eventually they will come up with something. You think of most of these innovations that we use today. It was really money that made it happen. GPS, for example. Now, GPS was something that the U.S. government, the military, wanted to have, and they basically threw a bunch of money at these scientists, and they said, "Hey, figure this out." And then they did figure it out. And then after a while, GPS became a thing, and then it was in public domain, and now we use it, and we all have it. We carry around one, on our phone, in our cars. So it was really originally money made that happen. Internet the same way. So it's just a matter of we need more awareness by things like this podcast. We need more money. And we need more people who are interested and study it.
Absolutely. Now, I know you brought up the geopolitical situation between the US and China briefly. I mean, is it fair to say that whoever cracks quantum, like really cracks it, is gonna have the tools to essentially dominate the next 100 years of our globe from a geopolitical perspective?
I hate to say yes because I'm, I hate for people to. My friends already tell me that I'm like one of these doomy gloomy people, but I think that once someone actually comes up with that technology in a scalable, sustainable manner, they're going to have a significant advantage. One of the things that quantum computing can do. So it's very interesting because you talk to all these experts. Nobody who knows anything about quantum computing, nobody says, this technology is just like whatever, it's vaporware or it's not going to work. Most other technologies, crypto, you talk to 10 people who are experts. Some will say, this is the best thing ever. Some people will say, I don't even know. This thing is worthless, blah, blah, blah. But in quantum technology, there's no noticeable or significant disagreement that whether it works. It's just a matter of who's going to get there first, which is very interesting and is different than other technologies. So I want that to be known. It's going to happen at some point. It's just how are we able to, or who's going to get there first? So one of the main things that quantum computing can do is encryption, and it can encrypt or decrypt things, based on how you program it. And I don't need to tell anybody how important it is to be able to encrypt our sensitive data, because theoretically, most encryptions can be broken. Most encryptions today, which is based on RSA technology, can be broken by a quantum computer, a scalable, real, sustainable quantum computer. And let's say some hostile government gets their hands on it, or they come up with a computer. They can probably access our sensitive data. And it's very interesting because a lot of companies are already thinking about quantum proofing their communication. No one has quantum computers yet to the number of qubits to be able to break, let's say, all the code. But a lot of people, I forgot there's a name for this. They make a copy of the encrypted material. They can't access it. They don't know what it is, but they can make a copy of it, and then they can break it whenever they have access to that computer. So,
We're now to
yeah,
think
no.
Yeah,
That's the
another.
thing.
I did an episode on that
Oh, wow. Okay.
over the summer. And I did one on post-quantum cryptography as well, because
Nice.
with the because you're absolutely right. Like, they I assume foreign actors have been downloading information forever,
I'm
right?
sure.
Like
I'm
forever.
sure.
They can't access it, but they have been doing it forever. And when quantum becomes available, they'll be able to go ahead and decrypt everything that they've ever downloaded, right? You look at folks like what's the word? You look at financial records, right? You want to look at what I spent money on 15 years ago. I mean, I'm sure there's some embarrassing stuff in there here and there, but like it'll be all right, but things like medical records might be a problem, right? Then you look at things like intelligence, right? Intel assets. Like, do you think that foreign actors, whether they be, Russia, China, you name it, would be interested in who was giving us information 15 years ago? I think they
Oh
would, right?
yeah.
And that can absolutely, affect people's lives directly. It's a concept that I think would be is interesting though is selling that information, right? That's going to be a whole criminal scheme at some point eventually. I'm sure it already is happening, where you're selling information that's, essentially encrypted, and selling it to people that can decrypt it. It's so outside of you were going somewhere, I apologize. Outside of looking at things like encryption and what are some of the other ways that you think?
I think it will impact AI in many, many, many ways. I think it'll impact our communication. Forget about the encryption aspect of it, just regular communication. It will make a lot of things easier. A lot of drug discovery, simulations, will be a lot easier. I know we have some clients right now who are actually doing that now. Anything that uses heavy computing resources and in an iterative manner, or it needs to simulate stuff, will be much faster. And that's a lot of different technologies, from drug discovery to regular communication to computer modeling techniques. A lot of academia, they model certain things like the weather or financial modeling. Financial institutions can benefit from this technology. It will have a wide range of positive impact. Now, I don't think you and I, or most people personally, need a quantum computer. Will ever really need it. Ironically, just like IBM would give you 15 minutes of free, Watson in 2013, they give you 15 minutes of their quantum computer now if you sign up, and that just, anybody can do that. I personally have played around with it. I don't really know what I would use it for, right? Because I don't really need that much computing power. However, bigger institutions and companies that provide service to us can use that, and then that will make our lives much, much easier. All that being said, I think the marriage of quantum and AI, that's the biggest advantage, in my opinion.
How will they, interact? How will and well, before we get all into how they're going to interact, are we utilizing AI now? Are there folks utilizing AI now to help try to help speed quantum development? Is that something that can be done?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So there was a paper out of Berkeley 3 4 months ago that so I remember how I talked about the modality and the ion trapping, and it needs to be cold and all that stuff happening. Someone or a group of scientists, I think they're all from Berkeley, but at least the paper said Berkeley, so let's go with that. They trained a neural network to exhibit quantum properties. So instead of the heart of a quantum computer, that was that fridge and the chip inside that would make basically a material exhibit quantum properties, you can replace all of that theoretically with a neural network. Now, that has obviously many advantages. Number one, doesn't have to be that cold. It can work anywhere. It doesn't, it's not sensitive to vibration. It basically needs a supercomputer. So I'm not sure if that is actually, I've read the paper. It was fantastic. I'm not sure if they're actually doing it now. But it sounds like there's some promising research that says AI can actually use or be used to replace the or be the new modality, or at least a part of the new modality for quantum computer.
Absolutely. And then, how do you think they will interact when scalable quantum is here? And is it, and how, and what, like, I would assume you don't need quantum for like LLMs, right? As a large language model. So, and what will you know, what, so, how will they interact, and what, use cases do you think we'll need to utilize quantum for that we can't do with classical computing now?
I think we can do the same thing with classical computing now. I mean, people are already doing it, right? But one advantage that quantum will inevitably provide is that the resources needed, the energy, is a little bit less or a lot less, depending on which study you go with. But everyone agrees that it is less. So right now, I'm sure you've heard of Microsoft buying all these, nuclear power plants and ChatGPT's, electricity bill, so to speak, is so high. And quantum computing could help with that. So it could do the same thing. It's already working, but it could do the same thing just with a lot less power usage, which is clearly an advantage. The other thing that it can do is, so AI, when we say AI, not every AI model is created the same, trained the same, right? So there are different phases. For inference phase, whenever it's trained and proper and just ready to be used, it can help it and it can run it with using less power, less energy. But also the training aspect of model before it's ready, it can also help with that process as well. Because so there are different training paradigms. There's a the main three are the supervised, unsupervised. Obviously, there's a semi-supervised, but then there's also the reinforcement learning. So for supervised and unsupervised, that's one column of training. You need a huge data set of training data, and you need to label them depending on which paradigm you're using. And then the model will have to ingest it every single time. It'll train itself, right? So, let's say that the classical example of cat versus dog image. You need thousands of dog pictures, thousands of cat pictures, and then it'll ingest it and iteratively it'll refine itself and learn what is cat, what's dog, right? So that process, because quantum computing can do parallel processing much, much, much better than classical computing, it can shorten that process and it can use less energy. So there's a huge advantage there. But I think the best use of quantum computing when it comes to AI training is for reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning, in my opinion, is a little bit like quantum mechanics in a way. It's an AI version of that because reinforcement learning is fundamentally different than regular training or supervised or unsupervised training. It provides this experimental space for the model to take an action and calculate the result, reward itself, or calculate a reward for itself. So basically, what the model does is it'll take an action, it'll see what the result is, and then it will evaluate the result and re calculate a reward number for itself. And then it will iteratively do that so many, maybe thousands of times. And eventually, it will pick the action that gave it the highest number of cumulative reward. So because it's taken all these actions, it needs a lot of computing power, and quantum computing can help. So the classic example of that is a maze. So if you go in a maze, or if the computer will try to, solve a maze, it'll go and take one step straight, go to the next block. Did not hit the wall. Okay, that's a good reward. If you hit the wall, that's a very bad reward, right? So a classical computer or anything classical will just do this one step at a time. quantum computer can do various, because it has a much better parallel processing capabilities, can do various iterations at the same exact time. So reinforcement learning paradigm that's pretty good right now can be much, much, much better and faster using a quantum computer. But again, we'll need a scalable, sustainable computer for that.
Absolutely. And I know me earlier you mentioned that the ions break down over time and are only useful for a certain amount of time. What's the current life, how do you, what's the current life expectancy of one?
I don't know, to be
Okay.
honest.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not, and it's not even that they break down, it's the coherence time, is that they only exhibit quantum properties for a certain amount of time. Or if they entangle with these other qubits, they only stay entangled for a certain amount of time. Theoretically, if something is entangled, it should always be entangled. But in reality, they haven't figured out how to actually do it. I need to look that up. I'm not sure what the time is, but it's definitely not enough for us to do the kind of calculations that we need. Now, there are various ways to mitigate that. There are all these error corrections because it's not that the computer won't give you results, it'll just be the wrong result. Now, it's not all of it wrong, some of it are wrong, which is actually more dangerous. If all of it is wrong, then okay, let's stop it, let's go to the next one. But the problem is, it just these errors just creep in, and there are various paradigms of correcting the error. So you don't need to stop the process, you just need to implement an error correction paradigm on top of the result that you're getting to change some stuff. Those are things that people are working on, but at the end of the day, it's just not a sustainable way.
Absolutely. Is from a geopolitical perspective, are our quantum computers and the ones made in China specifically, or other or elsewhere, are they all like, is the architecture the same, or do we have different approaches to how we're developing them?
Yeah, so the modalities, my understanding is that, I mean, they're ion trapping is not the only one, the only modality. It's just that it happens to be the best one right now. There's another modality that you can introduce, I think nitrogen. I need to brush up on that, but there's another modality that works with nitrogen. Does not need the temperature to be that low. There are other modalities that people are doing, but there's really three main modalities. And yes, everyone's to our to the to my to the best of my knowledge, everyone's doing the same thing. If someone comes up with a new modality, it'll be earth-shattering. So I'm guessing that everyone's kind of trying to do the same thing. And of course, people are trying to come up with new ways.
Absolutely. And now I know you mentioned that you think that you and I folk like folks like us won't need access to quantum. Not really. So do you foresee this being like set up specifically for researchers, and like a special people that just have huge amounts of compute or huge amounts of compute need will get to access it? Or do you think that excuse me, do you think that we'll essentially have data centers where you have like a lot of really high-end classical chips and be running quantum in parallel?
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. So, I might have let me rephrase what I said about regular people needing quantum. So, it's not that we'll never use it. It's just that you don't need a laptop that's only quantum. That's let's say there's a magical way to get like a laptop that's only quantum. You could use it. Let's say if that existed, you could use it. It doesn't really help your life because most of the things that you and I do don't need it. So I think realistically it'll be a quantum computer that's sitting somewhere and in a database, and that connects via some sort of a communication protocol, maybe like the cloud, to your computer, and then you'll have classical chips in conjunction with a maybe a Q chip, whatever they call it, in future. And certain data will go to the Q chip, rest of it will go to the classical. I think it'll definitely not replace classical computers. It will just be something that is used as needed.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think it'll
It'll be
ever?
an overkill, let's just say,
No, you
if we
know,
just yeah,
and
get rid of
man, I don't know if you know this, man, but overkill is underrated. Oh,
it. That's true. That is very true. That is very true.
but like, no, I know what you mean. Like, that we just like this is a level of, you know, it's a level of compute that most folks just don't have a need for in their day-to-day
Right.
life, right? Like, we just don't. I mean, it's this, it's what's a great example? You know, it's like NASCAR, like a car that drives in a car race versus the one that we drive on a day-to-day basis, right? Like,
Exactly.
I can drive a car that goes 250, 300 miles an hour, but I don't need to. I can get around fine at 75, 80, right? Like,
Right. And if you live in DC, there's traffic everywhere. So you're going like 5 miles an hour anyway. So it's, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a great example. I'm gonna steal that, and
You should.
I'm gonna yeah.
Please. Please do, man. Please do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, how do you think when do you think that this is gonna like this will be cracked based on what you've read and what you've seen? You know, when do you think we're gonna crack this? Are we talking like 15, 20 years? Are we talking 5? Are we talking like next year? You know, or are we
I
talking
think
next?
it's about 10 to 15 years from now.
Okay.
Like I said, most people who are experts and are way smarter than I am, nobody disagrees that this can be done. It's just a matter of when can we actually do it. Now, every once in a while, Google not too long ago, they came up and they said that we have a quantum computer that can do something that would take a supercomputer 10 septillion years. I don't even know how many zeros that is. Yeah, the Google announced that not too long ago. Yeah,
All
exactly.
right.
Like after like 100 years, it doesn't even matter, right? Like you and I are not going to be there.
Right,
So,
exactly.
they're like, oh, this will take 10 septillion years and it can do it in, 5 minutes or whatever. But I think a sustainable, reliable quantum computing, maybe 15 years, I think that'll be good. Now, that means the money has to flow there now. The innovations need to be protected now. And then in 10 and 15 years, people can see result. Because if you think about AI, money, usually the process. So I'm a patent attorney, right? So like I see the process of innovation and then when things actually hit the market. There is always the scientific community that says, oh, this thing is really cool and it's shiny and look how like awesome it is. And then sometimes private funding, sometimes the government, most of the time both those things. They say, here's some money, play around with it, here's the result that we need. And then those people get the money, they start innovating, and then that's where the patents come. And then a few years after the patents is where the actual product comes, first to market. Then there's some debugging and people playing around with it. And then after a few years, we have a product that people can actually use. I was reading a report not too long ago from McKinsey. Now, the report is old, relatively. It's from April of 2024. But it said something like US is now spending about $4 billion, US government, $4 billion. China is spending about $15 billion. And those are already about 25, 26% increase from the year before, 2023. But private funding has also increased about the same, 26, 27%. It's actually 26% year over year. So it looks like there's a lot of money being funneled through these various companies. There are four main ones in the US, or three main ones in the US, and I'm not sure which ones are in China, but there are many new startups popping up. I've read somewhere that about 70% of all quantum computing companies that exist now, about 70% of them actually were created after 2021, which shows the kind of, the innovation and the number of the innovation is following the number of companies, and the number of companies are accelerating at a huge rate. So I definitely see an uptick in this whole process, and that's really exciting. We We represent a few of these companies, and they're doing really cool stuff. Unfortunately, as a patent attorney, I can't really talk about that's the biggest problem that I have with my job is that I work on some cool stuff, and I try to tell my tell my wife or my friends, and they're either not interested or I can't even tell them. So even
Absolutely.
the ones that I can tell, they're like, that's not at all interesting to anybody outside your circle.
Yeah, man. No, I find it fascinating. And so I think a really great analogy that was just made on robots of red tape, I think last week or the week before. We were talking about like where we are in AI development compared to the internet, right? So when you think about the internet, right, the comparison that was made to me with AI is that we're currently, from an AI perspective, in the dial-up phase of the innovation process. Like we're really early, we're trying to download a picture and it's taking like 15 minutes, right? Everybody's logging on, they're hearing
It
you've
makes
got
that new weird
mail.
noise,
Yeah, absolutely. Like this is like the early 90s in AOL, right? Like this is a long, long time ago, from especially when you think about how far we've come. Where do you think we are, like when you think about the internet scale, right? Where do you think we are right now as it relates to quantum?
That's a fantastic point, by the way. I never thought about it. Yeah, we are. AI is going to be before I answer that question, because I do a lot of AI work. So, in 2013, 14-ish, it was more in the scientific community. I was at IBM and there are all these scientists and they're like, look, we just did the research for this and this is what we found out. Then the financial sector really got a hold of AI and they're like, this is really powerful. Let's just do some work. And recently, then a lot of other technologies or fields, they learned about AI and they started developing their own tech. And recently it's been kind of injected into the healthcare. And I look back at the level of service and all the cool things that they can do. And you're absolutely correct. It's just AI hasn't really taken off. Now the innovation might have plateaued a little bit. And when I say innovation, I mean patentable innovation, things that are truly novel. But the application of those innovations to different fields are absolutely happening right now. I think quantum is where AI was in 2010. So 15 years from now, or maybe a little bit more from now, we'll have some platform like D-Wave or someone. Who will say, hey, you can put in your information here and you can use our kind of like ChatGPT. Someone's going to come out of nowhere. When I say nowhere, nobody in the AI world was surprised that ChatGPT came out. But for most people who never used ChatGPT, it seemed that it came out of nowhere and they provided this thing and people start playing around with it. And then it accelerates at a different pace, right? Like when you open up a technology and people get to play around with it, it just opens up this whole can of worms in a good way, but it accelerates. I think so that's number one. But you brought up a very good point. We are exactly like where internet was. And the analogy that just came to my mind is that there's this duality. So when early 2000s, there are many companies that claim that they can do XYZ on the internet. And then we had that bubble, and I'm sure you're familiar with that bubble. But there was this duality that these companies, they claimed that they can do all these cool things and they were just completely full of you know what. But then there are real companies like Amazon, like Google, all these other companies that were actually doing. So at the same time that a lot of hype was happening, a lot of life altering technology was actually also being developed. That was the duality. And it's so weird because tech has that. There's a duality in AI right now. All these people, there's a duality in blockchain. Remember when blockchain became a quote unquote fad and all these quote unquote crypto bros just popped out of nowhere?
Of course.
Absolutely, right? So that was the duality. But blockchain was a fantastic technology and it works, still works. It's fantastic, but at the same time, so these two things were true at the same time. And I think that's where quantum is right now as well. There's a lot of technology that people are doing that will inevitably change. It's a big leap forward for humanity, the way internet was. But at the same time, there are some companies, and they tell you about their innovation, and you're just thinking, that's not really anything.
Absolutely.
The problem with being a patent attorney, the problem with being an attorney, is that you almost always get the unabridged, unfiltered version of your clients or their technology or whatever it is. If you're a family attorney and people are going through a divorce, you're going to get the unabridged, unfiltered version of your client's story. And when you're a patent attorney, you get to actually see beyond the website and the hype, and they actually show you their technology. So sometimes it's very impressive, sometimes not so much.
Absolutely. No, and listen, I've been on the receiving end of a lot of pitches where people trying to get me to usually right now it's go into business with them as a or put some money behind something, whatever. And it's just like, I don't because I'll you're you know one of the things that I with my background and kind of how I and my entrepreneurial spirit. And I hate calling it that, but I don't know what else to say. But like I a lot of the time I see like I literally had somebody pitch a business idea to me like 4 days ago, 5 days ago. And the immediate use case was not great, but I'm like, if you can do that, like we could let's apply it to a bunch of other people. Like there's other places that this can be work and be useful, but you're gonna have to give up that vision of it being this specific area. And I think you're right about like AI, the groundbreaking developments may have slowed down, but I think now where we are is an implementation phase of like let's actually implement this across a whole bunch of different sectors and see what we can do. Because there's like there's whether it's customer service or call centers or as an assistant to help you with like administrative tasks, there's a lot of green field to move into, right? There's it's an un It's a competitive space right now, but it's an untapped space.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And quantum, I would assume, is we'll get there eventually. It's just, we're so we're, what you're saying is that we're like at DARPA right now, figuring out how to send the first email.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. I would say maybe someone has sent the first email, but then the second one kind of sort of like showed up all jumbly and like, wait a minute, it worked once. What happened? So that's where we are right now. Which is ironic because DoD is spending a lot of money on these quantum companies. So
Well,
sounds like exactly the same phase.
I mean, they should. Like, I think that, I think when you think about a lot of the really successful innovations that have come to market over the last 100 years, I mean, government money's been heavily involved in a lot of it, right? I think that you look at from like airplane development, like there was a huge at the time it was a huge prize for whoever had the first the first plane, right? And there were some people that like the essentially the who's who of the day from a news perspective followed around because they thought that they were going to be the ones to do it, and it turns out these bicycle mechanics in North Carolina that came out of nowhere, and nobody like so like there's that, right? But then you think about like the internet, but you also think about things like, I mean, hell, I think Tempur-Pedic, the mattress, the actual foam mattress that like I'm pretty sure that used to be a that was like developed by NASA originally.
I had no idea. That makes sense.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw that on commercials when it first came out, and that stuck with me 20 years, 25, 30 years later,
That's
Camiar.
awesome. That makes sense. You're right. I have one and it's awesome and I'm happy that they
I
did
do
that.
too. And but like you think about like the government's never going to be the one that's going to take something to market really. Like the early upfront investment stage and putting money into a bunch of different places and empowering the citizens, I think, is absolutely a role for government. And public partnerships I mean, when the goals of the private and the public entity are aligned, can be really, really, really innovative. And I think that you look at like the FirstNet program that I'm not sure if you're familiar with FirstNet.
No.
So it's a program that was it was done by Department of Commerce. So it's a commerce program, but it was a in response to 9/11. Now I don't know if you were in the country on 9/11, Kamyar, or if what your memories of that day were, but like, do you remember trying to make a phone call on 9/11?
I was in Plano, Texas. I was in
Mm-hmm.
high school,
Yeah.
and yes, I do remember. It was crazy.
Yeah, man. You couldn't get through, right? You couldn't get
Yeah,
anywhere.
you're
And
right. I never thought about it. You're right. You couldn't get through. Wow.
that actually in that inability to get through because the network was so clogged
Right.
impeded first responders' ability to get there and do that and respond at all, right? And so FirstNet was a pro is a program that was created. I mean, I want to say it started in like 2010, where it was rolled out a broad, like a nationwide, cutting edge communications network specifically for first responders. And so, they worked. I think AT&T won the contract. And they, I had a gentleman who was heavily involved in creating it on and helping to stand it up from the commerce side on the podcast earlier or in October, I want to say,
Yeah.
September, October. But it's a how you look at your phone, like you can see in the top right, it says like Verizon or AT&T or whatever. This is
Yes.
a phone, like your phone, it when you're on the FirstNet network, it says FirstNet. And every year they do an annual test at the Super Bowl. And because the network is so clogged there, because there's so many people there. And they're always able to make calls, no problem, have great
Huh.
service because they have priority traffic. They move to the front of the line. I don't remember the full story, but like that's but the long and short of it is that it doesn't matter if you're in like, Dubuque or like in Iowa or Idaho, anywhere, you can have as a police department, fire department, you can have access to the same network speeds and the same network coverage that they have in New York City.
That's fantastic.
And that's like a great example of a public-private partnership that worked and worked successfully and continues to work and continues to work successfully. And I think that quantum obviously is an area that we need to continue to invest in from a public, from like there needs to be continued public investment.
Absolutely, absolutely. If and when, or let's hope we get there first, but let's say if China says, "Hey, we can decrypt certain data," that is when everybody will freak out, and then everybody will
Don't think they're
start
going to
flowing
announce
their money in there. Yeah.
I don't think they're going to announce it. I think
They're not going to announce it.
whoever does it first is going to be like, I mean, I think of it potentially as like the next atomic age, right? Like if you remember, there was the time before the atomic bomb and there's the time after the atomic bomb,
Right.
right? And we had to announce that to the world very publicly because like it's a lot harder to hide a nuclear explosion first, but
Middle of
right.
the war.
But
Yeah.
like second, part of the reason that the atomic bomb was dropped was to get Japan to like be like, all right, enough. And and like the only way that's going to work is with publicity and publicizing this new destructive weapon. But if we could have kept it a secret, and there was a strategic reason for for that, I think that we would have, right? Like I wouldn't advertise that. And I think that this is absolutely a situation where like, do you really want people to change their posture on this and try to rush to catch up with you? Or do you want more time to,
Do whatever it is that you want, right? Yeah.
cement a head start, like a further head start, right? Like, I don't think like I wouldn't announce something like this by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. Yeah. Crypto is going to be affected highly. Because you can technically, I mean, the whole point of crypto blockchain is it, let's say if you had a master key that could break into anything. You would probably want two things, right? You want state secrets, and then you want people's electronic wallets. That's one thing that I would do if I had that master key.
Absolutely.
All
Is there
right.
a way to, like, quantum proof the bl a blockchain or no?
Very interesting question. Yeah. So NIST, was it the National Institute of Standards and Technology, I believe. They were already working on this. So they came up with three ways of quantum proofing your encryption. Now, quantum proof is not the right name because it's not going to be quantum proof, but it's going to be they came up with three different paradigms to implement now. And so you're ready for when quantum computers are available and some bad actor can break into your system. So there are people already working on it. I know the US government officially has provided three different ways of doing it. But again, as you said, if someone has access to this and they really want to mess up some stuff, they can probably do some damage. Yeah.
And I don't think that, I don't know, like I think that, like, when you look at stuff like that, or the like a bank, like, I guess I'm not sure where a bank stores all their records. I would assume it's all in a secure, a secure data center somewhere.
Yeah.
We just kind of walk in and erase records or change them. And I don't know when the last time you got a paper statement was, but it's been a long time for me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, totally, totally. It's just I own as much as they tell the website tells me every day. So
Exactly.
that's most people, right? Like you don't actually know what you have. You're like, well, that's the thing that says on the page is how much I own.
Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely.
no.
But man, understand there's obviously the scary side and the potential downsides, right? And like
Right.
I think that's there with everything. But as you think about this space and your exposure to this space, what's the thing that excites you most?
We've been working with a few new startups, and they do drug design. So from molecule to actual drug, takes years right now. Because you need to, there are many, many, many calculations before you can even make the actual drug. And then you have to test it, you have to simulate it, all that stuff. And quantum can significantly cut that down. So we have a couple of clients who are doing that right now. And I think eventually they will figure it out. And eventually that process will be much faster, 10, 15 years from now. That's very exciting. You're right. We're focusing on like the encryption and bad actors getting stuff, but then there's a lot of good that could come out of this. We talked a little bit about AI and how it's going to be more efficient. If you can open up a way for everybody to train their own AI models and play around with it, who knows where that will go, right? So you can have much, much better applications of AI to different everyday things, everyday life. I think quantum can make that possible. There's a lot of talk about energy modeling that's right now not possible with classical, even supercomputers that quantum
What do you
can.
mean by that?
There's a lot of modeling that you can do for weather. There's a lot of modeling you can do for energy efficiency. That's so computer the computing resources needed for it is so high that's not really possible to do now, but quantum can do that. There's a lot of ways to make existing infrastructure of, let's say, electricity more efficient
Absolutely.
by and the way you do it is not there's no algorithm to do this. It's just that you have to simulate different situations. And classical computers are not very good at it, but quantum can do that much, much, much faster.
It's the maze example you were giving, right?
Exactly, the maze example.
One step
Exactly.
at a time, you're doing all the steps at the same time.
Exactly. You can do all the steps at the same time. It'll do it in minutes, and a classical computer will take, they say years, but even if it shaves off 1 year, that's already a huge win. So I'm really excited about what this technology can bring.
Do you think that it can help us with the development of sustained fusion power sources and things like that?
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm not as familiar with that technology, but if there's any computing that takes a long time right now, which I'm guessing they have that, it can help people in that field do whatever they're doing much faster. So it'll, at the very least, it'll make it a little bit easier for people to do their job. And that's basically all you want, right? It's not going to be magic. People think, people, a lot of people think, and that's the duality that I was talking about, right? So that people think it's going to be magic. The people think AI is magic. It's just a voodoo box that just comes out of nowhere and fixes everything. You and I know that's not the case. However, it'll make things a lot easier for people who know what they're doing. So yeah, sure.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that. And as we get ready to wrap up, man, is there anything else, any other points you'd like to make? Anything else that I'm, anything I missed?
No, I think that was fantastic. I think if there's one bullet point that I'd want your listeners to take away is quantum is very much real. And it's a different kind of computing. That's the biggest misconception that people have. People think it's like a faster computer. It's not. The amount of computing power rises exponentially as opposed to regular computers that will go linearly. So it'll make things a lot easier and faster.
Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate you coming on, taking the
Of
time.
course.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Everybody, thank you for listening to
Great.
Robots Red Tape. Hope you're having a great day.